Welcome to another edition of the Brain Injury Radio Network, sponsored by TBILaw.com. For automatic reminders about this radio show and other great survivor events, sign up now for TBISN.org.
When Attorney Gordon Johnson speaks about recovery, he isn't talking about the amount of money a survivor gets from a lawsuit or settlement. He is talking about getting better from the brain injury. Find him on the web at TBILaw.com or call 800-992-9447.
And now, it is time for another edition of the Brain Injury Radio Network.
Hello, welcome to Brain Injury Radio Network. Tonight is our regular Wednesday installment of our program Recovery Now with your host, Kim Justice. If you'd like to know more about my story, you can find it at inaflash.org. I, too, am a fellow traumatic brain injury survivor. I appreciate you tuning in tonight, and as always, I look forward to your input. So now, we'll get on with the show. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Brain Injury Radio. This is your host, Kim Justice. I'm really sorry that I'm having to do this show tonight, but I'm very honored to have my two guests. I'm going to take care of a little housekeeping, give some of the people time to sign in the chat room. Brain Injury Radio is on 7 nights a week with 10 different hosts. All of the shows, after they are live, go into the archive for on-demand listening at your leisure. We've also started a new earlier platform, and hopefully some of you here tonight listened to Lori Purdy Fatell and her show, The Science of Happiness, that comes on right before mine. But the slots are filling up for the 2 hours before, so there'll be 5 continuous hours of Brain Injury Radio coming soon. By the end of the year, I want to thank my sponsor, Lash Publishing, for all that they do. Their website is lapublishing.com, where they publish only brain injury related material, both for survivors and professionals. And we want to thank our Brain Injury Radio sponsor, Gordon Johnson of TBI Law. With that, tonight my show will have 2 featured guests, aptly one from New York City, the other from the Pentagon. My first guest is Anthea Appeal, who spent 20 years with the New York Police Department. She was a first responder on 9/11, retired shortly after, and she's going to share her experience with us tonight. My second guest is Staff Sergeant Tim Chambers, better known as the Lone Marine of Rolling Thunder, and he was stationed in Washington on 9/11 and was one of the first responders, among the first responders to make it to the Pentagon. My show is a gathering place for anyone seeking recovery from the challenges of life on life's terms. I introduce topics and survivors share their experience, strength, and hope. We discuss useful tools that have helped us lighten the load of our journey through recovery. We focus on the 4 A's of recovery: awareness, acceptance, action, and adaptation. This is a place for survivors striving to become thrivers. Now, without any further delay, because we do have 2 guests tonight, I am going to hopefully be bringing Anthea on the air with me. Are you there, Anthea?
This is fantastic. Right.
Oops. How'd you get up there? All right, Frank, we'll come back
to you. I don't know how I did, but
Oops. Anthea, is that you? Sorry, folks. We've got a full switchboard tonight. And Anthea, is this you?
Hello.
Hi, Anthea.
Yeah, I think so.
Great. I'm sorry we had a little trouble. We've got a full switchboard tonight of people wanting to listen to you, and I saw the 585 and knew that that was a New York area code, but 585 be one of our yeah, one of our other hosts there in New York. How are you doing this evening?
I'm doing very well. How are you doing?
Well, you know, good, but I'm always finding, I don't think there's anybody out there who doesn't remember where they were and what they were doing on 9/11. And a lot of us that think about it, I looked at the clock this morning at 8:45 my time, and I felt reflective. And I think every year at this time, I feel reflective. And one of my first signs of aging was going into a jewelry store probably 3-4 months after 9/11 happened. And I was with a girlfriend who was about 12 years younger, and there was a clerk that was even younger than that. And I was looking into the jewelry case, and I said, by the way, how much is that POW-looking bracelet on the end? And I heard silence. And so I looked up from the case, and I looked at my friend, and I looked at the little clerk, and they're going, pow, pow, POW. They had no idea what a POW bracelet was, and that was one of my first intros to You're Getting Older. And it got me
well,
so...
it should be in the history books.
Yeah, I was going to say, they're just not teaching the kids these days. Anyway, it ticked me off and I left. And the next day I went back and found a lady my age and I bought it. But what the bracelet says is, United We Stand, September 11th, 2001. And I haven't taken it off since. So obviously I'm in Omaha. It impacted me very strongly. I can only imagine what it's like for you on this day. But why don't we go back?
Go ahead.
Sorry? Why don't we go back? You were originally from Kentucky, is that right? You did a little bit of moving
around. I was born in Kentucky, and my father was an engineer, and we moved to New York City when I was 11 because he was working at the Grumman Aerospace firm out in Long Island. So we moved to New York when I was about 11. So I've been here all my life. I'm sure I have a New York accent.
Yeah, a little bit you do. And you were interested in photography. I noticed that when I was reading it.
Yeah,
that's
well,
an interest
my,
of mine as well.
Yeah, that's where I went to High School of Art and Design, and I went to college to study film. And that was my intention to get into the, to be a cinematographer and get into the entertainment industry as a working behind the cameras, but it didn't turn out that way. I took the police exam. I scored a very high mark, and, you know, I was a starving artist, and, there's no police in my family, and what I knew about the police department basically is what you see on TV, and so I went into the police academy and became a police officer.
That's quite a shift from being a starving artist, which I'm understanding that concept myself a little better now because I wrote a book too, so I can relate to that. But that's kind of a stretch from being an art major and photographer to a policewoman.
Yeah, well, it was a culture shock, going from film studies into Yeah, not that I could talk about film on the job that much, you know. Yeah. But you know, it's a good paying job, got good security, and get a pension and good health insurance and everything. So it worked out well, and there I was. And 20 years later, I had the opportunity. Well, you know, 20 years later, and 9/11 happened, and when I retired, I wanted to write a book about what had happened, because I guess you have to be a New Yorker, maybe a cop and a fireman to understand certain things, but there was a lot of politics going on at that time. And the fire department had lost, I think it was 348 men, and that which was an outrageous number, and the police, NYPD, lost 23 men and a female, and the Port Authority Police Department lost 37. And of course, a lot of attention was played on the fire department, and there was a lot of politics going on at the time, where the police department was being blamed for the deaths of these firemen. And believe it or not, we were being blamed, and we supposedly, people were accusing us that the reason we didn't lose as many men as we did is because we had information. We were tipped off that this was going to happen. This is serious, and we were just basically attacked all the time from politicians and the fire department. I said, I don't believe this. I do not believe this. I do not believe for 1 minute that we had a foreknowledge, and even if we did, we wouldn't have ran out there without sharing that knowledge. And we work differently than the fire department. The fire department, I know a little bit about how they handle a job, their protocol. But police department, because we are a paramilitary organization, we kind of work sort of like the military does in a way, like you would a Navy SEALs. We work in small teams. We work usually one boss and eight men. And especially, because you didn't mention I had written a book. Now, I had written a book about the NYPD and September 11th, the untold story of it, because I wanted to get out what we did do that day. And I interview. Right. I was patrol. I was always a patrol officer. And when I decided to do interview other patrol officers, there was something like 2,000 police officers had responded that day. And I said, "There's no way I can interview that many." So someone suggested you need to talk to the emergency service unit, because they were the ones who lost the most men. Most of the 23 were their men, and. And they work. There are, for those who don't know what an emergency service unit is, they are our SWAT team, but also our emergency service team. We're the only ones here in New York City that have a combination SWAT team and emergency. They're trained to, save people from hanging off a bridge, a jumper, someone trapped in a train derailment. They're trapped. They're trained for those dangerous jobs. And then, of course, if you have a hostage situation or you have a bank robbery, then they are trained to handle that, those type of tactics, and handle that. They are the police officers that a patrol cop would call when they need support. They need some help, because a patrol officer, we have our gun and that's about it. But if you got a hostage situation, then you're going to need the guys who are trained in that type of thing. So that's the emergency. And they would, so someone said, you got to talk to them. They're the ones who were down there doing the rescue, and they're the ones who lost most of the men when the towers collapsed, because they were in the buildings. And like I mentioned before, we work in small teams, one and eight, one boss, eight cops. That way you have enough men if there is an aided. If someone needs to be carried down, you got enough men. If there's an emergency situation, someone's trapped in an elevator, they got the tools, they got enough manpower to get that person out. If you have more than that, you got 20 guys or you got 30 guys, you are going to lose count. you know, because with 1 and 8, you can see who you have. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, you got 8 people, so that when it's time to leave, you can see everybody. With the fire department, it worked differently. There was many of them in there, you know.
Right.
I don't know the exact number, and it was spread out, because the World Trade Center, the way it was built is every floor was huge. It was huge. You were spread out, and everybody was spread out. Not all the firemen had radios, and so that's basically what had happened on that day. So I decided to interview the emergency service unit.
Can we back up for just a minute? And I do have all of the information I'm going to give everybody, both on the air and in the chat room, about your website and the name of your book and where to find it and all of that. I just wanted to go back, and when we talk about your book later, obviously I don't want you to give your story away. I encourage people to buy your book. But let's go back to the morning of 9/11 in 2001, and tell us a little of your story. Where were you, and what were you doing?
Well, I was at work. My story is not as interested. I did not respond to my precinct is in Queens. For people who don't know how New York City is divided, we have 5 boroughs: Manhattan, Bronx, Brooklyn, Queens, and Staten Island. I work in Queens, which is about 7 miles away from Manhattan. When it happened, I was working, but they only sent, at the time, the first tower was hit. Everybody thought it was an accident when the first tower was hit. Mm-hmm. They just thought it was an accident. And so they were sending from every command 1 and 8. Like I mentioned before, it's always 1 and 8 from every command throughout the whole 5 boroughs to respond to Manhattan. I did not get picked for that. I stayed they kept a lot of us behind because, well, we weren't sure what was really happening until the second tower got hit, and then you knew it was a terrorist situation at that time. So many officers were kept back for safety reasons, and also they had us doing, because we knew it was a terrorist attack, we were given assignments. I was assigned to guard some of the transit system, their transformers, to make sure that the subway didn't get blown up or this and that. And, you know, there was a lot of bomb threats that day. They were all phony, but, you know, people take advantage of that. And I think there was something like over 100 phony bombs calls coming in through the telephone 911 calls. But
right.
I listened to everything on the police radio, what was going on, but it was when I wrote the book, that's when I sat down with the first responders and the actual men who were inside the towers and what they saw, and so on and so forth.
So, this is Brain Injury Radio, you'll have to help me with math, but so you were an officer in 1993, wasn't it?
Yes.
Tower.
Oh yeah, that one. Yes, the first bombing. That was on February 26, 1993, and on that day they had there were 6 deaths and about 1,042 injuries. And
so you had been a police officer for about 10 years at that point when that happened.
In 1993, yeah.
Right. So, how did things change? I mean, since you had been a police officer through both of these events, did you notice after the first one that your protocol was changed that you were trained differently, the mood change?
In 1993, the mood change, no. What happened was that the police chief at the time, can't think of his name right now, I can't think of it. It's in my book somewhere. He put together something called a mobilization, where it's mobilization 1, 2, and 3. That's what he put together. It was to mobilize police as quickly as possible throughout the city. If there's ever an event like that, apparently, I don't know if the response was not that good that day, but that's the only thing they started was this mobilization protocol that they had, 1, 2, and 3, 1 being the most serious, where all police, 1 and 8 from every precinct throughout all 5 boroughs respond to a particular incident, and then 2 or 3 is a little lesser than that. You have number 3 would be called for a lost child, so you might call 1 and 8 police officers within a certain area of the incident to respond to do a search. You know, so that was the only difference. The thing on September 11th, when I was talking to some of the emergency service guys, I didn't realize that on Wednesday, September 12th, the day after 9/11, they were going to have, for the very first time in New York City, they were going to have a mock weapons of mass destruction response type of thing. And that was where they're going to have, they were going to have police department, FBI, FEMA. FEMA was in New York City that week. They were all, the fire department, everybody was in New York City that day to get ready for a mock weapons of mass destruction attack on Wednesday. They had a Pier 19 over there on Hudson that was ready and cleared for the this mock scenario, and that was supposed to be the headquarters and blah 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 blah. And I always remember when I was doing this book and interviewing the police officers, and I was talking to the emergency service unit guys, and they're the ones that would have participated in that mock a terrorist attack. And I said to him, did you know anything about that? It was supposed to happen on Wednesday, and on the very next day, on September 12th. They didn't know anything about it. Nobody knew all about it, but then they usually keep patrol in the dark anyway, but maybe the higher uppers in the department knew about it. But I thought that was interesting that was supposed
to
be. Yeah,
don't you find that ironic that there was a big space between 1993 and 2001, and that they would just happen to schedule that.
Yeah, I thought that was. I thought it was very, very strange that they chose September 12th, 2001, to have for the very first time ever this mock simulation of a terrorist attack. I thought that was very strange, and the fact that none of the cops I was talking to who would have responded didn't know anything about it.
And
FEMA showed up so quickly on September 11th. They were in town already.
Right. Well, they said, they've said after the fact on the, I usually catch one of the shows just as a remembrance that's on every year around this time. And each one of them says there had been increased chatter, I think is the terminology that they use, about the likelihood of attacks, but it had been going on for quite a while, but it seemed like there was more of it going on around that time. But of course, none of us were aware of that until we see the shows years after, 2001. So. How far, because I don't know my way around New York, the place that you wound up working that day, how far was it, and did you have visibility of the towers?
You could see the towers from where I worked in Queens. In Brooklyn, you would see it. I mean, I was only 7 miles away from Manhattan, you could smell it. The smell definitely came over. That smell lingered for weeks and weeks and weeks. It smelled like, to me, here in Queens, like a forest fire. And it was smoky for the longest time.
Did you have friends and people that you knew in that area?
that respond? Yeah, one of the cops that I used to see often on patrol. He was with the emergency service unit. I used to see him all the time. He was killed in the South Tower that day, and that was a bit of a shock. It was quite a shock.
Yes, I bet it was. You know, all over the world, one of the other things, aside from watching like a Inside 9/11 show on the National Geographic Channel or whatever they have on each year, is that here, where I live in Nebraska, every year we have a memorial park, and the main street that runs east and west through our town is a large expanse of grass leading up to the park, and a lady named Lynn Castriano, who lives here in Omaha, her brother worked in the North Tower and didn't make it, and every year now she, for at least a decade, has made a display with 3,000 flags in the ground. Each of them has a paper around it that gives the person's name, how old they were, where they were, where they worked, and who they left behind. And last weekend they put that up, and they'll leave it until the end of this next weekend. But the first time I saw it, you know, you're driving up the main street and look over in this field of flags. And every year I go and kneel down and look at the different names and people, whether they were passengers on the planes or in the buildings, and it's just so overwhelming and emotional. Now, you, with that training in 93, that terrorist attack, did you find that your attitude changed any? I mean, a terrorist act, right?
What, in 1993?
You know, well, yeah, I was just kind of wondering the change, because when you think about it, I likened this to the generation when Pearl Harbor happened. For them, that was a game changer around the country. You know, the first time that we were attacked on our home turf, but of course, it was over there. Now you go right in the middle of our financial district, and where the Statue of Liberty is. That's really an unnerving thing for everyone around the country. And I've gotten messages today from people around the world who are looking forward to hearing you and Staff Sergeant Tim talking tonight about this. The world was profoundly affected, and we haven't had the terrorist attacks with the regularity that they've had them in a lot of places in Europe. And so I just wondered, I mean, after that happened between 93 and 2001, did you find yourself more aware? Have any change
No.
of your feeling or what you did? You just, it
No.
happened, and you went, I guess you'd kind
No,
of
I
have
don't.
To. You just go about your business.
No, we just carried on. I don't remember any change, and except for that mobilization stuff that he started, that police chief started, and we would have practice runs every month, and I always got volunteered unwittingly for these mobilizations. And other than that, no. September 11th, that was different. I mean, when that happened, I remember the depression was something that was so thick, I thought it would never, never lift. And I couldn't wait for the time to keep moving so that I could get over it. And eventually, the depression lifted, and it was such a huge relief, you know. I mean, my whole attitude about what was important changed.
Sure.
You know.
And you retired the year after.
Yeah, I knew the world was not going to be the same after that. When I knew the world wasn't. I said, and I knew the job wasn't going to be the same anymore. And I remember saying to somebody, you know, I should buy stock in surveillance and stuff like that. And he says, why? I said, I think we're going to go into that 1984 thing of Big Brother. I feel it's coming now after this. And I said, I'm going to buy some stock in surveillance and protection stuff and all that stuff and anti-terrorist stuff that people can. He says, don't be ridiculous. I said, no, it's going to change. The world's going to change. It's not going to be the same world anymore, and it sure hasn't. I mean, look, now in New York City, you got surveillance cameras all over the place, everywhere you go, and you read what's going on with the, they're going to have drones going over American cities now, and you know, I've been keeping up with the technology that's going on, and GPSs in your cars, and you could be tracked with anything, and I knew that was going to happen. I felt it. The world was going to turn into 1984 after that. I said, I'm getting off the job. It's not the job I want to be associated with.
Right. And the whole country, I mean, you were right, rightly so. I mean, now how many times have you heard newscasters, regular citizens talking about post 9/11 when they're describing an event or a situation in the country. So it was definitely a redefining moment.
It was
for our
a big
country.
Redefining moment. And you know, 1993 was nothing. Nothing. 2001, that day, I said, it's not going to be the same. The police department's not going to be the same. I said, I don't want to be, you know, they're almost militarizing the police department now at this point. I said, I don't want to be part of that, you know.
And I wonder, you know, that day, if it would have stopped it. You're still in New York, that's correct. It didn't make you leave the city. Still keeping in touch with any friends from the police department? Or did you just pretty much leave that behind you?
Somewhat. You know, writing the book, of course, it was on my mind constantly because it took me 6 years to interview, write, and get it published. Was it 6 years? I think the book came out in 2008 or 2008. It took a while. You know, I've never written a book before, so this was a new experience for me. So it took a while, so that it was constantly on my mind all the time, and the guys that I interviewed, it was constantly on my mind, thinking about them constantly, you know, every 9/11, I get emails and messages from people who have read the book. I've heard from family members of police officers who died that day who read the book and thanked me for, because that was one of the biggest shocks. When I wrote this book, about 6 months ago, the brother of one of the police officers who had died never knew what happened to him. He would ask the other cops who were with him, but I guess he said they always would hold back. I guess they felt funny telling him the details of his last hour, you know, alive. So he was told very little, and so he was searching and searching and searching. He says, I've been turning stones over for the past, 12 years, trying to find out what happened to my brother his last hour. And then he picked up my book, and he finally found out. He says, I never knew. I never knew where he was. I didn't know who he was with. I didn't know what the circumstances were just leading up to his death. And because none of the cops would tell him, I guess they were afraid, you know, to upset him. And he read my book, and he just wrote to me, and he called me on the phone. We talked for hours, and he thanked me. He says, I finally have closure. He says, I never knew what happened to my brother.
God, that's terrible. Yeah. Do you mind telling us? We're not saying any names, but do you mind telling us where his brother was?
Well, his brother was on a team. It was Team three. They were emergency service police officers. They were in the North Tower, and they were going floor to floor. They were looking for civilians. And then the order, when the South Tower came down, of course, everybody was ordered to get the hell out of there. And that order came from a police officer. It didn't come from a sergeant. It didn't come from a captain. It came the whole NYPD, the whole emergency service units being in the tower was their communication was to a police officer on a street corner on West and Vesey. It was on West, which is right on the corner of where the World Trade Center is. I have to remember, not everybody's New Yorkers and they know the area, but where Building 5 is, that corner, he was right there, and he was coordinating all the teams, keeping them informed of what was going on, any changes, any dangers, any safety. And he when the South Tower came down, he got on the radio, says, everybody out, ordering all the teams in the North Tower out. And the firemen were also getting that message. And that was one of the misunderstandings and things that were the politics that were going on after the event. They said that the firemen's radios weren't working, which is possible, but cops' radios don't work either, and that a lot of the firemen didn't get the message that to leave. But every cop that I interviewed was with a fireman. They were together. They weren't separate. It wasn't like the firemen went this way and the cops went that way and never the two that meet. They were together. So they heard each other's radio transmissions. So they knew, but I think what happened is, because when the teams left, when they finally left, it was by the skin of their teeth that they got out safely. And because it was, a small team of only eight cops, one boss, they managed to get out quickly, and they dumped a lot of their equipment, too, to make the load easier. But the firemen had to go floor to floor to floor to get everybody together, so it was maybe that 30 seconds of delay of getting everybody together that made the difference as to why that many firemen died. They just didn't have enough time. They were a few seconds behind, and it made all the difference, but the cop that I was talking about, he and his team, they leave the North Tower and they get over to the customs house. And when they get to the customs house, the sergeant that was with them said, go into the customs house, make sure there's no civilians in there, come back to us, and we'll get the hell out of here. And as a matter of fact, those cops were with some firemen who were carrying down a civilian who weighed about 300 pounds and was unconscious. Mm. So the firemen and the cops are trying to bring this huge man out unconscious, and they're sitting under standing there under the customs house. And meanwhile, the debris is still coming down, continuously coming down, and which was really blocking their exit to really get out of there. And they're all pressed up against the customs house. And they said, he ordered two cops to go in, check, blah, blah, blah. And while they were in there, that's when the North Tower came down and landed on top of them. The officers who were in the customs house survived, but his sergeant and the other officers were outside. The firemen also survived because the police officers lit the firemen. There was a very small path leading to the debris from the South Tower, and the sergeant told the firemen, since you have this aided case, this unconscious man, you leave first. They survived. They left first, but the two cops, the sergeant and this police officer I was talking about, his brothers, they stayed behind and waited for the two cops in the customs house. But like I said, when the North Tower came down, they were killed, and the other two officers who were in the customs house were buried alive. They were trapped in the customs house. And they had to get rescued.
Now, when all that debris was coming down, obviously nobody was expecting that the towers were going to collapse. So there had been people.
Nobody.
I don't know how
far
back you had cleared the roads or anything, but people were just kind of, you know, from the footage you see on TV, there were people, you know, it looked like fairly close by because they're looking up and they're watching the fire. The fire is going on in the towers, and, of course, nobody suspected that those things were going to come down.
No, nobody. Nobody knew it was going to come down. And when that police officer, and it was Officer Winkler was his name, who was coordinating the ESU teams, the police teams inside the towers, when the South Tower came down and he raised the other teams, the police in the North Tower, he says, you got to get out of there. The tower, South Tower, just collapsed. And they didn't know what he was talking about. They thought, said, well, what do you mean it collapsed? You mean like the top part just tipped over? And they're like, no, the whole building is down. It's like, you know, collapsed. It's gone. It's nothing there. They didn't believe it. The cops and the firemen, nobody believed. They weren't near windows. They were all in the staircases, which is in the center of the towers. And they weren't near any windows. And the cops told me that the only reason they left is because they knew that Officer Winkler was a serious guy who never joked around. They said if it was anybody else, we wouldn't have believed it. He said, but Winkler sounded pretty upset, so they believed him, but nobody believed it.
Wow. So obviously that debris was, and the smoke from the fires were filling a large area, so even where you were, you had to be seeing all of that. You had been in New York for many, many years and walked by the towers. What was it like for you when you finally did get close enough to see what happened? Or were you catching that on TV? What was going on where you were?
I was
by the Port Authority.
I was not watching.
Were you hearing?
TV. Well, yeah, I was listening to the police radio. I mean, we listened to what was going on the police radio. I was on patrol with other officers, you know, with guarding the transit system. It was frustrating because you wanted to get down there, and it was nerve-wracking. Also, when I finally did see the towers, when I finally did get down to Ground Zero, because eventually we were being sent down there to do security, we didn't work on the pile. They had it. They had the area partitioned off with a wooden wall, and they would have the police stationed outside, the patrol officers stationed outside. And emergency service unit, ESU guys, were on the pile because they're trained in rescue. They're trained in rappelling and for building collapses. So, of course, they were on the pile doing the work. But somebody like me would be outside doing security. But when you saw it, it was like that image of at the end of Planet of the Apes. You remember that film and the end where Charlton Heston is going along the beach on the horse and he looks up and sees the Liberty Statue of Liberty collapse.
Yes.
That's what the feeling was.
That must have been I know for, like I said, I'm in the Midwest and everybody I talked to was just sick seeing it on TV. That must have been, well, I mean, it's a violation, you know.
It was frightening, and like I mentioned, it was extreme depression. I think I walked around. Everybody was walking around like zombies. It was like disbelief. It was a terrible depression. I remember the planes waiting for the F-15s.
Yeah.
And it took them forever to show up. It took them forever to show up, and they were
out in the ocean for some reason.
That was the strangest thing. I didn't understand why they were being. They were coming from what, Massachusetts, and it took them forever. It took them 90 minutes to show up, and I remember being really angry, and because I didn't understand. You're just showing up now, 90 minutes after the whole event. So,
right.
You know, but it was a relief when you did see them. And they came in low, too. And I remember that feeling pretty annoyed, angry, because I didn't understand. And also, where was the president? It took him, how long did it take him to address the public? It took him days, I think. Do you remember?
Well, he was flying around. I know that one of the things that made me nervous, you know, when you talk about where you were on that day, and in my case, I got up, I was getting ready for work. I got a phone call from a girlfriend of mine, and she said, "You've got to turn on the TV right now." And I turned on the TV just in time to see the second plane. And my parents, who live here, were vacationing down in Las Vegas. And, of course, it's earlier there, and I didn't even think that they would be up yet, but I plopped down. I just kind of stopped in mid-getting ready for work, and I remember plopping down in my big chair and watching, and at first, you know, you want to think this is some kind of a, you know, that you're seeing things. And then, like you said, they had been talking prior to that about it being an accident. The news was still talking about, you know, a small aircraft getting off course. But to sit there and watch the second one coming in so fast and lower it looked, I just, for me, the way that I reacted to it is that I didn't get out of that chair for like 3 days. There was something bad about 24-hour news. I think, you know, the rest of the country was shock. Certainly not the same as you, but in shock. And, you know, I sat there. I finally had to have a friend who had a little more wit about him, I guess, at that moment, tell me to turn off the TV. You know, it was amazing. It was going on. And my poor parents, you know, of course, they stopped the planes, you know, all wound up getting grounded. And, of course, when an emergency happens anywhere, you know, you think about wanting to get home. And they're halfway across the country, and the planes had all been grounded. There wasn't going to be any way out of Las Vegas to come home. They got one of the last rental cars that was available, or I think maybe they even, I can't really remember, they might have had a rental car down there on their vacation and hijacked. I mean, didn't take it back when they were supposed to and headed home. Not really. But they were driving across the country, and of course, you know, they could get news, but when you're driving across the country, it's cutting in and cutting out, and you don't really know what's happening. So I remember having conversations with them, you know, because the minute that second plane went, I called my parents in Vegas and woke them out of a dead sleep and did the same thing to them my friend had done to me. Turn on the TV right now, something terrible is happening. And I remember while I was in that chair for 2 or 3 days watching, I was talking to them on their drive across the country about what was happening, because of course when that happened and then the Pentagon, we really had no idea what else might be coming. I mean, there was a few different elements playing into that. You know, one is actually seeing what just the horror and the shock on so many levels of what was going on in the towers. But then the fear, you know, when the president did take off from Florida, I remember distinctly I was in that chair and he flew somewhere down southeast first, and then he flew here to our Offutt Air Force Base, and they told that on the national news, and I came unglued. I thought, why would you tell these terrorists where he's at? You know, New York's over here, Omaha's over here. They just, you know, they're broadcasting, you know, where he's at, you know, and this was one of the stops, you know, on his way that day. And I remember I was fearful just from the moment I turned on the TV that morning, and by afternoon, late afternoon, you know, they're showing footage of the president landing here, and nobody knew what was going on. Of course, nothing like that was expected or anticipated. And then when the planes hit, that was one thing. When they started coming down, that was another thing. I'll never forget those first shots they were showing. Of course, the first shots had so much of a debris wall and the smoke that it wasn't as evident. But, you know, when you'd been around for a while, you're used to seeing the towers. And I'll never forget the first time I saw the footage and they weren't there, and cried. It was horrible. But also, we didn't know what else might be coming, you know. And then the Pentagon came, and of course the news people, you know, they're all scrambling for the story at that time, and hearing, you know, reporting on some rumors and speculating, and you know,
there was a lot of rumors, right. A lot of bomb scares. You know, people were calling in. They were calling in pranksters. On a day like that, you're going to have pranksters calling in. I'm getting a cell phone call from my husband. He's buried under some rubble, and everybody go running over there to look for. I think she claimed her husband was a Port Authority police officer, and he was buried under some rubble. And of course, when they pressed her for more information, and then the name that she gave, the officer, that the alleged name did not appear on the roster, did not even appear in the Port Authority Police Department at all. It turned out that it was a fake, it was a hoax, and she was arrested. But somebody in the chat room wants to know if how many other people were affected brain injuries. I don't know, post-traumatic stress come under brain injuries, because I know that was had increased. That was a big problem. I remember there was a female officer in my precinct who did respond. The 1 in 8 that they did send down from my precinct to the Trade Center, she was in the van, and when they pulled up, they saw the North Tower get struck. And then later on, they were caught in the smoke, the debris cloud and everything, and they witnessed everything. And then the very next day, she was sent down again to do security. And the minute she pulled up to the scene, and she was all jittery, they sent down the same cops who had witnessed it. They sent them down the next day, and of course they were all jittery. And when they pulled up onto the scene, that female officer broke down and started crying, and she couldn't stop crying. And they escorted her over to One Police Plaza, which is our headquarters, which is about 3 or 4 blocks away from the Trade Center. They walked her over there, and she sat with a priest. And then they it's kind of hard to explain unless you've got to be a cop to know this, but they took her guns away. You know, which is kind of like an insult. You can't cry, you can't feel sorrow without them putting you on modified duty, you know. And that happened quite a bit. The police department's not very good in handling any type of emotion. And, you know, female officers do display emotions a little bit more. They cry, a male cop. But there was one male officer that I interviewed for my book, who did suffer. He didn't get hit over the head, but he did have some issues. He did talk about having some brain trauma, but he had post-traumatic stress, something terrible. And I remember meeting him at Starbucks to do the interview, and he broke down. He cried and cried, and he was very upset. He ended up ended up leaving the job on three quarters on disability because of this is post-traumatic stress. And I think one of the things that contributed to his post-traumatic stress was, if you read the book, he was a narcotics police officer. I don't want to give out his name or anything, but if you read the book, you're going to know who it is. But he was from a different unit than the emergency service unit. And one of the things about with post-traumatic stress is when it's important is you need to talk afterwards. And with the emergency service unit, they did their own debriefing because they wanted to debrief us afterwards. Everyone's supposed to be debriefed and have someone to talk to about what you were going through. And cops usually clam up. They won't talk to shrinks or they won't talk to any outsiders. They talk to each other. They talk to the partner that was there with you. And this is even they discovered this was even true with Vietnam veterans. Because I think the way they used to do it during the Vietnam War is they would have a platoon, but when your rotation was finished, it would send you home. And it would send you home separately. You didn't go home with one of your teammates or your platoon mates. You went home by yourself. And you went home sitting on that plane and getting home without ever having a friend who was there that witnessed it with you to talk to. And that's why a lot of Vietnam veterans suffered more post-traumatic stress. And the Army realized afterwards that it was better to send the platoon home together, not separately like they used to, so that they can deal with the post-traumatic stress better, because you need someone to talk to. And this particular cop never had anyone to talk to about what he went through until the day he sat with me in Starbucks and talked about what happened to him on September 11th inside the North Tower. And he's been waiting years. He says, I didn't want to talk to a shrink. I didn't want to talk to a civilian. I didn't want to talk to some higher echelon at the police department. I wanted to talk to a cop. And he finally did with me, and he was able to break down. And I had that happen several times where they needed that, to talk to a cop, not a shrink.
You know, you might be surprised, but it's been bore out that it doesn't surprise me that you'd say that. A lot of our listeners here, and why you got the question in the chat, and I'm going to modify that question in a minute and ask you something else, but, you know, everybody, a lot of the people who are listening tonight are survivors of brain injuries, or caregivers, or hopefully more and more professionals in the neuro area. And one of the things that we found as a community is that peer-to-peer support, and they even proved that back in the 30s with things like Alcoholics Anonymous, 170 other 12-step groups have sprung out of that first 12-step program because they found that one survivor talking to another or that peer-to-peer support is one of the largest components of recovery or composure or stability or, you know, whatever level you're going to make it to, normally is by sharing your experience with someone who's walked in those same moccasins, as I say, because they're going to have that understanding, you know, that level of understanding. And I don't know why, you know, even in this group and even in maybe in that group, you know, that there was probably some survivor guilt and just emotion. They didn't want to talk about. It's another example just of how peer-to-peer support works in a lot of different contexts. So I'll bet you did get
it. You've gone through it. You understand. That's why in the military, on the battlefield, or there at 9/11, it was the guy standing next to you. He's going to understand. And that's who... They would sit together at the precinct and at their quarters, and talk about it and talk about it and talk about it. But when you, when it, like this particular officer, he didn't have anyone to talk to. They didn't even, his coworkers at where he, in the unit he worked in, didn't even know that he was in the North Tower, didn't even know that he did what he did until he got a medal. He was awarded the Medal for Valor along with these police officers. They didn't even know. They were like, what? Because he had no one to talk to. He wanted to talk to someone who was there, who went through it. And for that reason, he suffered so much that he eventually had to leave the department on disability.
Right. A couple of questions then out of that, and one of them is, did they give, I know it's the, not a way to say it, the gift that keeps on giving, the tragedy that keeps on giving, but I know that they can't even, as far as that question about brain injury, obviously there had to be a lot of them, but we hear about the fatalities and the numbers in the fatalities. Has anyone ever put a guess out there on the amount of people who were injured, the people who survived but were injured?
Well, you're talking about the illnesses that are happening with all these police officers coming down with cancers? I mean,
well,
something like 1,400 cops, 1,400
right.
police
no.
officers and firemen have died from breathing in that poison toxin. That was like Chernobyl on the Hudson, as someone who lived near the Twin Towers would call it. Chernobyl on the Hudson. It was like a dirty bomb that went off. And, yes, many officers have succumbed to many terrible illnesses from that.
And what about in the Depression, another thing that happens a lot of times when people have survivor guilt and they can't shake that depression, and if they're not talking and they're holding all that inside, will often commit suicide.
Well, I haven't heard that happening.
Good.
But the cancer I've been hearing, and also, and the depression that comes with it, because the police department and the city of New York, for the longest time, weren't giving out any type of compensation for it. I think they had the what's the name, the H.R. 847 bill, that was the James Sirota 9/11 health bill, that was the Compensation Act of 2009, and he was Detective James Zatroga. He was the only death officially linked to the toxicity of 9/11, and a link that was later rescinded by the head medical examiner of New York City, who accused him of being a drug addict, which was, his father was absolutely livid about this, because his pain medicine, supposedly he was addicted to, or something like that. But the father of Detective Zadroga, he went to City Hall and made Bloomberg, our Mayor Bloomberg, recant and apologize that comment. And then after that, the James Zadroga 9/11 Health Compensation Act is to amend the Public Health Service Act to extend and improve protections and services to individuals that were directly impacted by 9/11. So that finally came around. But, you know, the EPA lied to us. Oh, my God, did they lie.
About
the toxicity down there. I wouldn't go down there. I refused to go down there. I said, my friend who's from the Ukraine, who's Russian, she says, don't go down there. It's going to be like Chernobyl. You're going to see leukemia. You're going to see cancer. And she kept, don't go down there for any reason. And sure enough, that has happened. But EPA, OSHA, they lied. Christine Todd Whitman, who was the head of the EPA, you know, she kept saying, there's no reason for concern. Yeah. Right, and there's 1,400 dead now since.
Exactly. That's what I was wondering. Just prior to that, though, and then I was gonna, we'll go on and step back to that just a little bit. But the day of 9/11, itself, we were being told about the fatalities. But with all that debris falling, I was wondering if there were guesstimates on the number of injuries on 9/11, people who didn't die but that were hurt badly. Did they ever have a count of the injured from that day?
I don't have the numbers on that. I know talking to some of the police officers, I know there was a group of ESU officers who, when they first arrived down the Trade Center, were trying to get to their command posts to get into the towers, were being stopped by injured civilians because apparently people were being hit by the debris. I remember it, talking about a man hit in the head. He had a big gash, and one woman had a broken arm, and there were other injuries that they were, kept fixing everybody up because they had their first aid kit, and they would fix everybody up and escort them to an ambulance, and then they had to get to the command post. But I don't have a number on that. But there was injuries.
Yeah, I was going to say, obviously, there would be, and there would be a lot of head injuries. My God, all you have to do is watch the footage, of that day.
Yeah, funny, I don't have a number on that, and I don't really remember reading too much about it. There was a story of a woman.
I don't either.
There is a story of a woman who was splashed with the jet fuel. She was waiting for a bus right there on West Street. West Street runs right next to the North Tower. And when the North Tower was hit, the jet fuel was shot out, and it landed on her standing on a bus stop. She got covered in it, and she was seriously burnt. I think her name was Ruth. I have her name written somewhere, and she was drenched in this boiling hot jet fuel. And I remember reading her story in the New York Times, and she was running, she ran into the arms of this man who got her to an ambulance, and he said her skin just peeled right off her. But she died something like 3 weeks afterwards from the burns.
Right. I was going to say that could be one of the reasons. I don't know who keeps track of numbers like that, but there were so many that were injured that day. When they're counting the deaths, they're talking about the deaths of that day, but not only were there injuries sustained that day where people wound up dying like the one you're talking about, but in these years since, I've heard the stories too. And when you talked about that bill, I wonder what kind of bureaucratic jungle that must be trying to prove, because obviously
it was hard to prove. They didn't want to believe us. They said it was your imagination. It was something from a prior. It took a lot of fighting. I don't have the information in front of you, but I would cut everything I would find about 9/11. I would cut out of the newspaper, and I remember something about civilians, but I don't have the numbers in front of me, especially with post-traumatic stress. But I don't have the numbers in front of me. I got the name. It was Jeannie Ann Maffeo. She was M-A-F-F-E-O, a 40-year-old woman who had been. She was standing at a bus stop, and she had third-degree burns, 90% of her body, and she ran into the arms of a guy named Ron Clifford, who grabbed her and got her to an ambulance. And she died 42 days later of kidney failure. And it turned out that Clifford's sister, Ruth McCourt, was on the plane that struck the North Tower. And that was she ran into the arms of Ron Clifford, and his sister was on the North Tower. That was a strange story.
Now, what made you decide to write the book? Was this part of you went into a deep depression, which
As I mentioned at the beginning, there was a lot of politics going on and finger pointing that it was the police department's fault that so many firemen died, that we weren't sharing information, and I did not believe it. And you should have read the press that I was reading up here in New York City and on the internet and newspapers, the horrible things were being said by the about the NYPD. And I said, there's no way in hell a cop who had information would walk by a civilian or a fireman and not share it with them. I said, I have to find out the truth. I got to find out what the police did in that. Because people thought, if you read my reviews on Amazon, people were like, really, the cops do that? I didn't know they did. You know, they thought we were just standing around directing traffic. No. We had cops in there saving civilian lives, and there were some interesting stories. You have to read the book. There was arrest. There was a very strange man arrested inside the North Tower. There was some very strange things that were going on, and the police were, you know, getting themselves involved in these strange people. And and so I that's what I did. I said, when I retire, and the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to find out what we did that day, and that's where I ended up interviewing all those emergency service cops and putting their stories together. And the book is basically told from their point of view. I put it together that way with the teams that were in the North Tower, and of course it was hard to interview the South Tower, but you know, whoever saw them last, and I just weaved everything together.
How many people, I'm sorry, maybe you said it at the beginning, but how many people did you talk to put, how many interviews did you have to put this book together? And then I'm going to give you the audience information on how to find it, and then we'll have a little bit of a question or comment.
Because I know
from
you have another. Yeah, well, I think I have like 100 hours
worth
of it. Oh, okay. I had about 100 hours worth of interviews. I really lost track how many cops I spoke to, civilians I spoke to, firemen I spoke to, fire chiefs, actually, because I didn't know, you know, I didn't know the protocol was fire. I wanted to learn about what the firemen do when the situation's like. So I talked to fire chiefs about, you know, what was happening that day. And also, you might find interesting the story of the Oliver Stone made a film called The World Trade Center about saving those two Port Authority cops that were buried under there. I spoke to all the rescue workers that were involved in that, and what Oliver Stone left a lot out. He left a lot out, and I spoke to them, so you'll get a detailed count of what happened during the rescue of John McLaughlin and Jimino, police officer Jimino, who were buried under the South Tower for, it took 8 hours to get Jimino out, and it took until 7 o'clock the next morning to get John McLaughlin out. And so that story is in the book. The helicopters, there was a lot of controversy about the helicopters. I spoke to the police officers that were in the helicopters hovering by. They were waiting for, nobody got to the roof. Nobody got to the roof.
Right.
And they were waiting for someone, anyone, to get to the roof, but nobody got to the roof. And I found out later because they were locked. The roof doors were locked. But even if they did, would have been dangerous. The heat was so intense, and the wind was so strong, the helicopter pilot said that if they had even tried to make an attempt to land, it would have helicopters, their blades would have collapsed. But they were going to take that chance. If just one person got to the roof, they were planning on lowering one of the police officers down, and he was going to try and lift them up. But that never happened.
That's incredible. So, Anthea's book, and I did type this in the chat earlier, but obviously that doesn't get our audience out there. I'm going to tell you her website, and so you put www. Her first, all lowercase, anthea.com. And I'm going to put that in the chat room right now, pel.com. And this is her website. And that will give you instructions on how to find the book. The book is called The First Responders, The Untold Story of the New York Police Department and September 11th, 2001.
And
you'll find
it's only right
on
now.
It.
It's only available a Kindle. It used to be a physical book, but I had an incident with my publisher, which I won't go into on air. But I had to dump him ASAP, and as a result, the book is out of print. But you can get it on Kindle. I'm trying to get the book back in print again because I do have some never-seen-before photographs that, in that book that I want to get, you know, out there again. So give me a few months.
Exactly. I did tell, just so our audience knows, if you Google Amazon and then you get to Amazon and you just type, there's a search window up at the top, just type in her name, A-N-T-H-E-A space A-P-P-E-L, and that will take you right to her book, and it shows that it's available in the Kindle edition, so it's as easy as blanket.
Well, get the Kindle. They are still selling. Amazon is still selling some of the used, old edition. Don't get that one. Don't get that one. I don't want that old publisher to be getting a 1 cent out of me. wait for the new edition to come out. Just, you know, the Kindle. Just the Kindle. And I've re-edited, too. I've done some editing and so on, and new photographs, and that would be in the book coming up.
Yeah, I was going to say the Kindle would be a good way to be getting that book if you want to read it now. Certainly if you buy the book when it comes out, the physical book when it's re-released, you definitely want to get those new photographs and things like that. So just tell us, and then I'm going to take a couple of questions, and then hopefully Staff Sergeant Tim had a whole day worth of things to do today and was doing a prayer vigil, and so I'm expecting him any time, I'm hoping, in the next 15 or 20 minutes. So we have time for the questions, but I was interested when I was reading your bio and your website because I, too, am interested in photography, but then I saw that you're a pet lover. So tell us what you've been doing besides writing books since you retired from the police department.
Yeah, I went back to school, and I am board certified in something called animal naturopathy. If you've heard of a human naturopath, I am an animal naturopath, and I am about to get board certified in homeopathy. So I will be a health alternative veterinarian, so to speak, in quotation marks, for cats and dogs. Well, any animal, as a matter of fact. I've helped baby goats and horses, too. But so I work with animals now.
That's awesome. Well, for a girl with four dogs and a sun conure and two goldfish that lasted much longer than they should have, Betsy and Ross, as a matter of fact, they lasted 2 years in a bowl. Can you believe that? But in any case, that's a big change from being a police officer. But certainly, when I was reading your bio, you've always been an animal lover, and so I'm happy that you're doing something that makes you happy at this time. So sorry that you had to go through that experience. Again, somebody asked in the room, right now her book is only available on Kindle. But all you have to do is go to Amazon, type in her first and last name, and it will bring up the Kindle edition. Don't buy the hard copy. It's going to be re-released soon, or the book. I mean the book. Copy is going to be
re-released. Soft cover. Yeah, that's the old one with the old publisher. I don't want him to get a penny after what he did.
Well, and even aside from crooked publishers, you know, like you said, you've done some editing and
I've done some editing, and I put some new pictures in it, and so, you know.
Right. I just wanted to make that clear. Kindle. Only available on Kindle right now, but I think a lot of people, you know, the Kindle app is free. So if you happen to have an iPhone, this guy in the chat room, I'm going to test him. He got a new iPhone, and he and I both joke. I've had mine a couple of years now, and I still say my smartphone is smarter than me. And he just got his, and I will tell you, LP, that there is a free app on your phone. Yeah, he needs training wheels, he said, for Kindle. So you can download that. If you have an iPad or a smartphone, you are able to get a free download of Kindle, and then you can buy those books and read them on your iPad or your smartphone, if you can see that small. When you're my age, you just do it on your iPad,
yeah, it's
not
too
the phone.
Small.
Yeah.
And the photographs, the photographs would not come up properly on the Kindle and the smartphone. So I did, the photographs were not included in the Kindle for that reason. It just didn't look good, so I took them out. But,
I'm curious,
you know, and the book would come out with a lower price too. The book was be a lower price than it was originally when that publisher had it.
Great. Well, yeah, cut out that middleman, and that'll help you a lot. I might be able to help you with a couple aspects of that. So, are you able to take a couple of questions?
Sure. Uh huh.
Okay. Good. First, I'm going to put on the guy whose mic I picked up accidentally the first time, because he's there in Rochester. But, you know, I'm in the Midwest. I don't know what all your different area codes are in the New York area. I also don't know how a couple people got above you on the switchboard, because you called in sooner. So I guess it's just another one of those joyous flukes of technology. But this is... Frank, and he lives in Rochester. Frank, you're on the line with Althea. Did you have a question or a comment?
Hi, Althea. I want to tell you what I did when the towers came down. I watched a movie that it was a Jeff Goldblum one where the aliens came down and they I watched that for 2 or 3 days straight, because in that movie it showed that America could bounce back from anything. And with their ingenuity, they overcame the aliens. They ended up destroying them by using, I can't remember what they did. They came up with an ingenious way to break through their shields they had. And
right.
I watched that for days till finally I got over what the heck had happened to us, but we really haven't done the right thing. The TSA doesn't really do its job right. They frisk down old ladies and disabled people at the door, and they aren't really doing the right job, in my estimation. But there hasn't been another attack except the bombing in Boston that got by us.
Yeah, well, it shouldn't have,
I know.
I think the Russians warned us, didn't they?
I think the Russians warned us about them.
Yeah.
I don't know why the hell.
Well, Al-Qaeda warned us before New York, too. So, you know, it's
I know they did, but no one
carry every cover at all.
Yeah.
So that's what my experience was. I remember exactly the day it happened. I was on the phone with my friend, effing Kevin. Effing Kevin stands for F word, because every other word I was on is the F word. And I call him effing Kevin out of love. And he said, Frank, turn the TV on. There just was a crash into the towers. I said, what the hell are you talking about? I saw the second crash, and I didn't even believe what I saw.
Nobody did.
Now, I've met another guy, a guy at the, I think I met him at a Neil Donald Walsh conference. I can't remember his name, but he was investigating what really happened, and according to him, there was an inside job, because the way the towers crashed down, they crashed in, like, a demolition had been done. I saw a demolition done up in Rochester. They blew up this building and it went down exactly the way the towers went down. And
well, it was
so
interesting. I was just going to say, because one of the police officers, well, a couple of the police officers, one said that when the South Tower came down, he heard what sounded like an explosion, boom, 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 and he clenched and he covered his head because he was waiting to get hit by shrapnel, but he didn't get hit. So he heard that booming sound, but when the second tower came down, he did not hear that boom, boom, boom. But one of the other officers, he was standing on the corner outside on West Street and Vesey. He looked up and around, he said to me, about the third of the way down the North Tower, I guess around in the 30s, he saw an explosion coming, just flying out of the 30-something floor, coming down towards him, all this debris, and then the tower came down afterwards.
Well, I know there's a lot of speculation and conspiracy theories out there. I'd just as soon not breach those tonight.
Yeah.
You know, I'd prefer not to.
I hear them all. They all come to me. I get all the emails and I get all the questions, you know, and it's a hard thing to talk about that subject, the conspiracy things, because I'd rather keep with the spirit of the book.
Yes, I would too. I know that goes along, and thank you for calling in, Frank. Like I say, I know that goes on, but it just isn't anything that I want to go there. You know, they're still thinking that people didn't really land on the moon, but were bouncing around in a bouncy room somewhere in California, and all kinds of that stuff going on. But you know, until I hear the proof, I guess, it was a tragedy. It was a tragedy. I'm just going to leave it at that and take our next caller. Area code 610, you're on the line. Who do we have with us?
Hi, so this is Madeline. So, interestingly, I was in the World Trade Center on that day. And I actually, I never go in there, and I happened to miss my train and ended up there by accident. I was on the last pass train, and I saw the second plane fly into the building overhead. That cop that you talked about on Bay Stay and West, I talked to him.
Oh, really? Blonde-haired guy?
I was in shock, and I can't remember much about his features, but I know the cop, I know the spot, I've been back there and recreated it, and I went up to him, because I said to him, what the hell's happening, and the first time he said to me, the second plane had just hit, and he had said to me, I think a small plane hit the World Trade Center, and I said, that's impossible, they don't allow them to fly in the airspace, and he goes, then something must be wrong at the control tower, because a plane just flew in. And then, like, within a short period of time after that, I think it became more evident what was going on. But in the beginning, many people didn't have a clue. I mean, it was so unfathomable. And, you know, like, even when I was inside the building and there was smoke everywhere, and there were cops, but they were calm. They were not at all panicky or anything. There was no sense of you know, this was a terrorist attack. It was like, you know, and I'm a New Yorker, so you think, oh, it's a subway fire.
Yeah, right.
And, and the lady who got burned, I was on the other side of the building. And then there was Father Judge, who was killed by a falling body. But it was very bizarre. It was very interesting listening to your story. And my, oddly enough, my ex-husband, also, who never goes there, he was an EMT, and he was off duty, but he was in an ambulance, and they hijacked the ambulance and went there, and they were there when they were under the North Tower when it fell, but they survived. So both of us who never, ever go there have no reason by freak chance were there that day. So it's very... very bizarre experience, and a lot of strange, lasting things from it. But you know, the cops. I mean, everybody who was there, the cops, the firemen. In my opinion, they all did a fabulous job, as much as you possibly could with a situation like that. I was also, believe it or not, in downtown in '93 for the first one too.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah,
and
people,
I guess you work in Lower Manhattan then.
What's
that? Are you still living in New York?
No, but I didn't leave because of that. I left because, well, not directly. I left because I spent another year and a half there, and I decided it affected me profoundly. And I was very proud of the city because I thought the city came together amazingly afterwards. But I decided to, I wanted to change my career and do good in the world. And I changed my career and moved to a different city, and then unfortunately was involved in a very severe car accident on top of 9/11. So that sort of things changed for me again, but I would go back to New York in a flash. I refuse to be afraid. But it was, you know, it was very, you know, the things that I saw the people jumping out of the building, you know, the hole in the side of the building that looked exactly like the shape of an airplane. You know, I don't think I will, and I saw the building collapse, you know, I don't think any of it will ever totally disappear from my memory.
No,
but thank you to all the police officers and everybody for all your efforts.
You're
now,
welcome.
Have either of you, before you go, and I want to ask Anthea this too, the new memorial. Have you been there?
I don't think it has opened yet. I was contacted about. I think it was 2 years ago. It was like January or February. I think it was like 2 years ago. They were putting a museum together, and they contacted me because they found my book, and they only had stories and memorabilia from well, I don't know if we call it memorabilia, but artifacts, I guess, concerning the fire department, and they didn't have anything from the police department. So they came across my book and they contacted me because they wanted me to contact all those police officers because they were recording everybody's stories and like an oral history type thing, and they wanted some of the police officers to give their account on videotape for the museum. So it's not open yet. So I went down there and I took a look, but I didn't go inside. So I kind of helped put that together, at least the police department side, you know. And I contacted all the guys, and I said, "Come on, we don't have anything from the police department for that museum. Let's help them out." But
I don't think it's open yet.
I was
down there at Christmas time for the first time, and like I went a lot right afterwards, and then I couldn't stand to go there anymore, and. Then at Christmas time I went there, and I just started to open parts of it, and but some parts were still closed to the public. So I kind of just went around and looked at parts of it. At some point, probably in the near future, I'll go and I'll go up and I'll visit it and see things. It's still fairly traumatizing for me.
I haven't been down there. I think I was down there about 2 years ago, I think. I brought for the 10th year anniversary because I went down there and I retraced the steps of the cops with a video camera. And I did that. And there was a big blue wall all around it, so you can't see. And the crane.
You can go to the World Financial Center and look over because you're at height.
Yeah, I did that. I went into one of the buildings there. That was Liberty, one Liberty Plaza.
Right.
I went up there because
right.
that's where the museum, they have their offices there, and I was up there, and we looked out the window because they wanted me to see the site from the window. And over to the left, there was a huge building there, and apparently it's a penthouse. And he said, you know who lives in up? That's Jay-Z lives there. Jay-Z lives right next to the Ground Zero.
Oh, for gosh sake. I know that the reflecting pond is open. I talked to a woman yesterday who had been up, and no, you're right, the museum is not open, but whatever part of it is, they're charging $2 is all. And this woman that I talked to was at the reflecting pond, so some area, I guess, is opened, and no, not the museum yet. I wondered, how long did the pictures, one of the memories I have, Madeline, I'm sorry. You know, when you were giving some of those visualizations, I was remembering back to all of the pictures of the missing that were on the fences around.
Like heartbreaking, I cannot, to this day, I work down there, and I got to tell you, seeing those photos every day, I couldn't stop crying every day from that. It was so painful. It was really painful.
Yeah, I know. Every time I see them, I feel that way too. Were they there? How long were they there?
Months, and they faded. It was very creepy. It was very eerie because the rain and the weather, they started to fade and they started to get lighter and lighter, and it was almost as though the ghosts of the people who had died had vanished. And so there was this gradual fading away of the faces, and it was there. They were there for a very long time. And there was a makeshift in Soho. There was a makeshift museum, and then people donated all of the photographs that they had taken. Any strangers who had taken photographs. So a lot of people had taken photographs, and that was up there also. It was things like Dean and DeLuca, they had put up a giant display of water bottles, of red, white, and blue water bottles. And all of the, every single, deli and fast food joint had a sign in the window that, cops and firemen eat for free. And that went on for months. I mean, it was really incredible. It was really, both wonderful in the humanity that people showed or in the wake of everything and the tenderness and heartbreaking in the tremendous wound it created. I mean, it was just enormous. So, But anyways, but thank you for talking about it. It's interesting to hear the other perspective. And it's interesting you also said about the tumors. You know, my ex-husband, like I said, he was there, and a couple of years ago it was benign, but he developed an enormous tumor and had to have radiation because it was so fast-growing, and they can't figure out what the heck it was all from or why he got it. And, it's very strange. I mean, I totally believe that all that asbestos and everything, it just caused a lot of health issues.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was toxic what was coming down,
Right.
I was just going to say that when I went out on the concourse, I the first thought I had was that there had been a parade because there was so much debris on the ground. But then I realized it was chunks of stuff and not just paper.
What was that?
I was just saying, do you need to take another call now?
No, no, I was just going to tell you, I was waiting until you finished, and then I got a text here that says, tell Madeline Craig says hello and ask her when she's ready to start helping out on the peer support line. So I guess you know our founder, Craig Cecilia, then,
yeah,
huh?
I do. You can tell him I'll talk to him. I'll send him an email.
Yep, he's listening. All right, smart aleck, Craig.
No.
Madeline will send you an email on this.
I'm
thank
one of the few
so
people who got PTSD first and then a brain injury, but, you know.
Right,
I did it backwards.
Exactly. Well, I wondered when you said that you had a car accident later, so maybe you should call me and instead of Craig and come and be a guest on my show and then get around to helping Craig with Pier 1-1 for him being a smarty on my show. I think I get dibs on you first, but thank you so much for calling in, Madeline, and sharing your experience with us. I appreciate you doing that, and I'm sorry, so sorry that was something that you had to experience. But thank you for sharing it with us tonight.
Yeah, thank you.
Yep, thank you very much. And I also have a blog on it. It's called Dura Matters, if anybody ever wants to look for it. But thank you. Thank you all for your comments and for sharing your stories as well.
You're welcome.
You bet. Good night.
I was going to say yep. I experienced a concussion once. I heard you mentioning that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and they're showing more and more not only concussions, but repeated blows to the head. That post-concussive syndrome causes damage in the brain. They have more and more science to back it up now. You know, in the old days,
you can recover.
You know, you'd
from it,
fall
right?
on your head and get what they call a goose egg and stick an ice bag on it and shine a flashlight and not let somebody go to sleep, and that was the end of it. And they're accumulating a lot of statistics now saying that those things did in fact cause damage. You know, the brain, the skull is like a cage and the brain is loose in there,
mm-hmm,
and every
mm-hmm.
time your brain gets slammed against your skull, it's bruising your brain, and the cumulative effects of that can be as bad, if not worse, than a direct TBI or acquired brain injury like I have. So, in any case,
I had a car accident where my head went through the windshield. And when I went to the hospital, they looked at my ears. Oh, I don't know how they determine whether you have a concussion or not. They look at your eyes, and the pupils are okay, and they look at my ears. They didn't see any blood. But for 6 months after that, I felt stoned. I felt out of it.
And that is one of the signs. And that's, you know, when your cognitive ability or the way that your brain functions changes, that is evidence of the brain injury. And for so long, traditional medicine hasn't validated that. You know, I think back at, you know, when I had my surgery, and the doctor, the neurosurgeon who was visiting at the time, I was blessed he was visiting, teaching our doctors how to do a relatively new procedure. And back then, you either got a brain clip or you died. And he said the surgery was a success. Well, to me, that
mm-hmm.
meant I was going to go back to who and what I was before. What he meant is he saved my life and the procedure was a success. But nobody really ever gave a heads up about the residuals that come with the brain injury, like the emotional fluctuation and what I call full basket syndrome, sensory overload, mood swings. There's so many things that go into a brain injury, and traditional medicine just hasn't validated it. In fact,
I didn't get any follow-up on that, and I felt like I was in a fog. And it went on for 6 months. It was the most horrible feeling ever. I don't remember the mood change. And all of a sudden, one day, I just snapped out of it.
Well, you were very lucky. You were very lucky that happened, because not everybody does. But I noticed have a caller from my area code here. Area code 402. Who do we have?
Dale.
Dale, thank you for calling in. Did you have a question or comment?
I was just kind of late in tuning in because I had some band stuff tonight, but I thought I'd tune in for a little while because, you know, the whole 9/11 thing is
kind of...
Dale
Hayes.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm sorry, Dale.
That's okay.
The board has been filled tonight. So this is Dale Hayes, folks, and he's one of my gracious independent musicians who allows me to play music on the show. His band is called Garfan, GARFAN.com. So go on, Dale. Thank you for calling in tonight.
Well, no, I just thought I would call in and say hi. You know, there's been a pretty fair amount of 9/11 stuff going on today anyway. You know, I wonder if this is something that it will take a generation for us to get over.
I think it might take longer than that.
Maybe. I mean, children. I run into some people don't even know what I guess if you're younger than 12, you were. They don't even know what 9/11 is.
Right. Well, they might not have the emotional attachment to it, I guess.
Yeah, we're too young.
But, you know, hopefully, you know, we all knew, and I don't know what the education system's like now, but we all knew about Pearl Harbor, even though we weren't there. But obviously there's not an emotional attachment that's quite the same as it was for this couple generations that lived through it, because see, now those people, those young people you're talking about, their reality is that they are living in the post 9/11 world and don't know the difference.
Yeah, that's true.
You know,
that's absolutely true.
And there was a difference before. There wasn't a, like you say, there wasn't a camera. Even here in the Midwest, we've got a camera on every street corner a lot of violations of privacy going on with the Patriot Act. But what do you do? You know, how do you second guess these things? I don't know. I guess I can't judge it. I'd like to know that, you know, the time between now and 2001 that we haven't had that kind of a cataclysmic thing going on repeatedly, and that's one of the things that's helping. But, you know, I guess we never know. As Dale knows, in the situation with his wife, and most of our survivors here on the show know that none of us have a guarantee when we get up in the morning. You know, there just aren't any guarantees. You never know what's going to happen that's going to be a game changer in your life, or if you'll have your life at the end of the day. That's what I learned from my experience, and certainly I'm sure both of you. Dale's wife had a brain aneurysm like I did, but she didn't fare as well and has been in a nursing home for 8 years. And probably getting closer to 9 now, huh, Dale? But I appreciate you calling in. And
Sure. I've been listening for a little bit and decided to buzz in. Like I said, I was a little late because, you know, I had some band things that ran overtime tonight. It was kind of we had a gig coming up, so I had an emergency. We had to have an emergency practice and meeting for it. So, but I remember exactly where I was at. Deb and I watched the planes crash into the towers on TV. You know, they kept showing replays of it, and we were both just stunned, you know.
Mm-hmm.
At first, we thought it was a hoax. You know, we thought, well, you know, this is a clever trick. And we were on our way over to my son's apartment. We got there, and he had it on the TV. And at that point, we forgot, wait a minute, there's really something to this. And then, you know, we thought, well, was it like a private plane maybe that crashed in and, you know, three or four people got killed? And then we saw the reality of the situation. Like I say, we were able to watch the planes crashing in over and over again because they kept showing it. I mean, it was just,
yeah,
just stunning. I mean,
and so
you,
that
you don't
was
know what,
before,
you, what to say.
That was before Deb had her aneurysm then. That was a few years before.
Oh, yeah. That was because that was in 01, and her aneurysm occurred in 07. So,
right.
You know,
right.
July 2nd of 2007.
Wow.
So, you know, it hit home pretty hard for us, I know, because her dad had served in the military. Her dad was a career Navy man. So, you know, things like that, you know, being a military brat was kind of a, you know, a thing for her. But,
right.
Yeah, she took those kind of things to heart. I have made a special request that they not let her watch those things at the nursing home because, you know, she gets upset watching them. So,
yeah,
you know, and then, of course, she gets frustrated because there's nothing she can do about them.
Right.
You know, even though she would mm-hmm. desperately want to because, you know, that was always her nature. I mean, she put on a benefit for the Katrina victims even. So, and I mean, the woman was a dino. She organized it all, you know, and had bands that we had a venue lined up, and she had bands from noon to 1 a.m. 9 bands performed, so. But, yeah, so the whole day has been, I think, kind of a tribute to that. Now, I must, you know, admit that I haven't stayed, you know, glued to, you know, the details on it, the post, you know, cataclysmic details and everything. Were there many people that suffered, say, a traumatic brain injury as a result of the two towers?
We don't really know that. We were asking about that earlier, and, you know, both of our guess would be that with all the debris that was falling from the buildings, both inside the buildings and in the aftermath of the debris cloud, all the things flying through the air, there had to have been a lot of brain injuries and head trauma, but we don't have a count on that. We hear about the people that didn't make it, and we don't hear a lot about the survivors. We're hearing more about people we were just talking before about that are developing cancer and other diseases now from the asbestos and the poison debris that was in the air that a lot of the first responders and people down at Ground Zero breathed in. But that'll be a good thing. I should have looked it up before the show, and certainly now I'm going to go look it up after the show and see if anybody did give any kind of account just as far as those injured and if they ever broke it down to brain injury. You know, one of the reasons why I would say that even if they had, the count wouldn't have been right is that doctors and hospitals are still misdiagnosing that after all these years. You know,
right.
I was misdiagnosed in 1995 for 24 hours that could have killed me. And the year that I've been a host, all these years later, 18 years later, they're still not calling it. And, you know, people are experiencing things like, you know, a loss of cognitive function or some kind of shift. You know, the brain is really command central for everything else in the body. And from the people I've heard, you know, and the stories I've heard all these years, there's so many of these things that just aren't getting picked up by the doctors, and they're not getting validated. And so, you know, even if they had numbers, the numbers would be low and they wouldn't be correct. But
probably accurate, yeah.
You know, I too certainly would like to know. I imagine there had to be an awful lot of people who were injured and are still carrying those injuries to this day, people that were survivors but that got hurt and are probably still hurt. So, but I've got a couple more callers, and we're still looking for, and this is great, Anthea, I appreciate you staying your on East Coast time later with me, and I think that Staff Sergeant Tim Chambers is running a little late. They had him hopping today, doing a few different things, and he in Tucson, and so he was going to be calling in. I would expect him any time. In fact, I've got a strange number here that I'm going to try and see, and then I will grab you in just a minute, Les Paul, but I've got a 111 number, and I'm going to check and see if that's possibly our next guest or...
Possibly. I was going to say something about asbestos in the World Trade Center. There really wasn't asbestos in the World Trade Center. Prior to the complex being built, the Port mm-hmm. Authority planned to use 5,000 tons of asbestos containing spray on floors, and from 1 to 40, and after that, mineral ore, because the New York Times, there was an article in 2007 that confirms that anticipating a ban on asbestos, they stopped using asbestos by the time they reached the 40th floor of the North Tower, and that was the North Tower was the first one to go up, and after that, they didn't use it. They used something called slag, which is a mineral wool. But it's not immune to the effects of a very hot fire. It's only good for passive fire protection. I think it melts at 2,000 Fahrenheit. But mineral wool is made of a natural or man-made minerals or metal oxides, which is fiberglass, or rock or stone wool. Anyhow, it can be absorbed into the body by breathing it in. It irritates the eyes, skin, and respiratory tract. And it was used to be labeled as a carcinogen. But by 2001, the International Agency for Research on Cancer removed it from its list of carcinogens.
Wow. Okay. Well, that's very good to know. That's very good to know. Let me see this mystery caller, and we'll see if it's Tim or if it's a troll. So I've got my finger on the mute.
John Gotti kind of has a little history with the World Trade Center too.
Exactly.
They were
Hi,
the ones
who do we
who
have
the
on the line?
Hi, it's a troll.
Hello, who do we have with us?
Hi, it's a troll. Hello,
okay.
Tim.
Hello.
Hi, this is your cousin, Jenny. And
Jenny, hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. I
the number
want
came
to
up odd. It came up 111. Sorry, I didn't recognize it. It totally was a surprise. The number came up 111-111-1111, so I had no idea. Welcome to the show, and I'm sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
Thank you. I just want to compliment you on the topic. It is so appropriate for today, obviously, and to your current guest and your upcoming guest, like the rest of the United States. This day is profoundly etched in my life, as it is of anyone that I would think that was probably over about the age of 12 on that day. And no, I don't think it's going to disappear in a generation. I think this is the second Pearl Harbor for the American history. And mm-hmm. it is important that just as with Pearl Harbor, that we never do forget. And that we not only acknowledge those whose lives were lost in the tower, in the Pentagon, and in Pennsylvania, but also the literally thousands of lives that were affected by those deaths and the deaths of the responders. It's amazing to me the complexity of what that single day in time has done to us as Americans and rewritten American history.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Exactly. That's what she said at the beginning of the show when she decided to retire, that things were never going to be the same again. And now, you know, I've taken note that we are so often referring to things in casual conversation as post 9/11. You know, I mean, it was definitely, you know, again, a game changer. And I appreciate you calling in. I thought that it was really important that we do a tribute to the survivors tonight, and was very fortunate that Anthea was willing to come on. And Staff Sergeant Tim Chambers is running late, so for all you Marines out there, if you're out there listening, he did have a number of engagements today, and so he might just be running a little bit late. And but we've had so many questions here that I think he was going to give me a text when he was coming, but we'll just continue with the questions. And we just have a couple others. And when you get tired or when our questions run out, then I'll have an outro for you, and I will read you guys some interesting things about Staff Sergeant Tim, and then I'll find him tomorrow, and he's going to be in big trouble because I'm a Marine's daughter and I'm Irish and Italian, so he better be getting his booty over here right about now. But Anthea, you just, everybody's very interested in, Jenny, thank you for calling in. I appreciate that.
My pleasure. And Athena, thank you for all the years of service that you gave our country. And I know that being the type of woman you are and having been in the chosen profession, that you continue to go to give every day and to teach those that you touch, just as Kim is teaching those and touching others through her lessons in life. Thank you both.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
Good night.
Thanks, Jenny. Good night. Okay, somebody who's been waiting almost all of the show, and I call him our Southern Gentleman. This is our Tuesday night host, and if you like music, you're going to recognize Les Paul. This is Les Paul Morgan. Les, meet Anthea.
Anthea, thank you for coming on tonight. This has been an amazing show, and your story's been amazing. And I've been sad, glad, happy, and mad all day just thinking about what happened all those years ago, what seems like minutes ago when you see the news and you hear you talking about it, you remember what you were doing. I told yesterday when she was talking about doing this show, when I called in, that I'm actually taken aback because just thinking about all the people that were lost. My mother comes running into my room saying, Les Paul, wake up. I'd had a bad migraine from my brain injury. And she said, they're attacking America. She said, they're attacking America. And I said, what? Well, who? And I'd had a severe migraine. I could barely even see. My eyes were so blurry with pain. Uh-huh. And she said, get to the living room. We don't know what's going to go on. She said, I'm afraid they're going to attack our whole country. And I said, who? What's going on, Mom? And by that time, I get to the living room, and the second plane hits the tower. And I couldn't breathe. It stunned me so bad. I mean, it's like, oh, my God, what did I just see? Right as I walked right in front of the television, and she said, please sit down, watch this. There's something terrible going on. They're attacking America. And I felt like my heart fell out of my chest and fell on the floor. And it's just amazing what the firefighters did that day, running up the towers. I remember that being on the news, how instead of running from the towers, many of them were running in to try to rescue people. And they died.
You don't think twice about it. It's your job, the police and the firemen.
Yeah.
You just
all,
went in.
All the medical people, everything, they were there to serve. And I think about all those husbands and wives and children that lost their parents that day. And someone said a while ago there were no children lost, and I had posted, I feel for the children that were lost. I know there were children lost.
No, that was me. There were no children.
Well, on the planes is what I meant.
I don't think so. Was there? I don't think so. You know who was killed on one of the planes? I don't know if anyone knows. Marisha Berenson. Sister. What was her sister's name? Marisha Berenson's sister. I can't think of her name. She was married to the actor Anthony Perkins.
Okay.
I can't think of her name.
Me either.
Her name was Barry Berenson. Barry was her first name. Barry Berenson. She was on one of the planes that hit the tower, and that was one name that I remember. I don't think there was any children on the plane.
I posted a link that I found that talked some about them. That's the only reason I said it. Unless it's wrong, I don't know it.
Well,
it didn't
actually,
talk about,
yeah,
it said
right.
There was only a small number. It didn't say there was a large number. But it
actually,
said some,
Les Paul, you are right. You are right. And the only reason I know that is, I was, when I mentioned earlier about Lynn here in our city doing that display of flags with each one having a name around it, there was a parent with a couple of children, and it gave their name, so I can't remember exactly how many.
Okay.
They were on their way to some were on their way to Disney World, and some were on their way, I forgot where else. I actually posted a link on it on this chat board, but it's been moving so fast I don't see it anymore. But it's, when all that happened, it's hard to know what happened, who, where, why. And I know we talked about the brain injuries and disabilities that happened that day. I work at a disability center called Walton Options, and the reason I want to know that, I've never seen any defining statistics saying how many people were injured and became disabled, or at least a good statistic, because it might never be truly known, because a lot of times somebody gets hit in the head and they see people dying all around them, and they think, wow, look, I survived that. And they may forever have the lasting effects of a severe concussion or something that's not visible, or someone may have broken their legs, or someone may have became a quadriplegic when something heavy fell on them, that kind of thing. I mean, when something that big hits and destroys two massive towers and people are running in a huge cloud of smoke and chemicals, you know, a lot of bad things happen. I'm thankful to meet you today. And that book, say the name of the book again, I forgot the name of it.
The First Responders.
It sounds awesome. When you do the second, you said you're going to do a new version of it or add new.
Well, I'm going
to
do, I'm going to reissue the soft cover book. It's available now in Kindle, but I had, it's out of print as far as the book is concerned. Yeah.
Well, I'll wait till the new one, the paperback comes out, and I will buy it then. And I'm just thankful for you coming. I don't want to take any more time up just in case anybody else wants to talk or anything, but it's amazing getting to meet you. Thank you so much.
That's great, Les Paul. Thanks for calling in. The next person I have, he must be Skyping in because I actually have a name for him. This is Philip Kirshner. Philip, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Shalom, shalom. I was a member of Bedford-Stuyvesant Volunteer Ambulance Corps in Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn. Also a member of the West Hamilton Beach Volunteer Fire Department. How are you?
Doing well. Tonight,
I'm not a TBI sufferer, but I have a whole other list of. I probably could be considered because of the other illnesses I have, but I can go down the line. Cardiomyopathy of the heart, which was treated 2 years ago at the Cleveland Clinic. Renal cancer, obstructive sleep apnea, arrhythmia. Well, that's part of cardiomyopathy. I get migraines, and I have one kidney that has been in stage 4 of my kidney disease. I'm also the co-host of Revelation News Radio, and I took a trip down the rabbit hole and I started investigating 9/11. A lot of the doctors blamed my PTSD on my obsessions with it, but at the same time, those buildings don't come down like that. Being a volunteer fireman, I know what brings the building down, and planes do not do that.
Well,
I sleep with a CPAP. What I will say is, for 2 weeks, I was fighting to get a new masking tube, as well as water chamber. And then on the 10th, I lost because I'm not getting good sleep. I'm yelling at him, what does it have to take on the eve of 9/11 to me to go to the media on how we're being ignored? And, okay, just because you, cause you're supposed to send me this every 3 months. What do you want me to die from a respiratory infection? Because you can't.
Is there a question?
Did you have a question, Philip?
Yeah, can my sleep apnea cause TBI?
Oops.
Okay, I had a trouble understanding what he was talking about.
Yeah, I think Philip's mic just went dead. So, sorry about that, Philip. But maybe call back another night. Tonight we're doing a tribute to 9/11, and Brain Injury Radio is something that we do talk about brain injury 7 days a week. Tonight I'm focusing more on survivors. You know, one of the reasons why I did this show, and then we've got all of the questions here, so in any case, is, you know, survivors. You were a survivor. One of the reasons I thought of doing this, not only that it's 9/11, although that was the biggest reason, because that profoundly touched me. And when I was looking through my calendar to book my guests, I noticed that, you know, I do a Wednesday night show every week. And as I'm flipping through my calendar to book somebody, I got to 9/11 and saw that it fell on the regular night of my show. And so I thought it would be nice to plan a show around 9/11 survivors. And, you know, everybody in our audience, leave out the caregivers and the professionals that are listening, but a large core of our audience are survivors. And, you know, the trauma, whether it's from a natural disaster, a terrorist attack, or your brain blowing up unexpectedly, you know, there's a process that we all go through. And part of that is a grief process about what was. And what you said, you know, so eloquently earlier when you decided to retire, that things were going to be different from now on. You immediately had that realization. Not everybody does. You know, it takes everybody a different amount of time to process, but we do go through a grief process for that which was lost, and we do go through a process to where we are today. Everybody does that at a different level. And then we come to an acceptance, and like I was reading what my show is normally about, the four A's, you know, we come to an acceptance that this change is real and this change is permanent, and then we adapt as best we can to have a quality of life worth living. And that's why I read in the early part of the program that we're aspiring here to not just be survivors, but to be thrivers. You know, as long as we still have a breath, it's a shame to waste a second chance or a third chance or a fourth chance. We hear them all here at living life and making it miserable. And so, you know, we've got to know when to go seek help when we're in that grief process, or we can get stuck so easily, and that can ruin the quality of life that we have left. And everybody goes through some kind of tragedy or trauma. I think almost, okay, I won't say everybody, almost everybody goes through some kind of tragedy or trauma in their life. And, you know, that's the come to Jesus hour, I guess, you know, when you reset your priorities and focus on what's important. And a lot of things that you thought were important before suddenly become pretty superficial. And if we had a superficial way of identifying ourselves, like by a label on us, I'm an executive, I'm a survivor, and you encompass your whole personality in a superficial label, you know, then you get the rug jerked out from under you when reality hits, and you need to reconnect with your core, you know, your core identity, which has to do, you know, with your faith and your hope and your ability to be a fighter and to come to acceptance and to do things for, you know, and I say this all the time on the show, that, you know, on our tombstone we have our birth date and our death date, and that our life is the dash in between. And we might not have a choice as to how the cards are dealt. You know, you didn't have any choice or knowledge of what was going to go on 9/11. I didn't have any choice or knowledge ahead when at age 35 I had an aneurysm that ruptured. A lot of our audience that's here tonight, you know, our TBI sufferers who've maybe gotten in a car accident or done whatever else has given them a blow to the head, and it's changed our lives and our perspective forever. And so there's a lot of common features in the word survival, regardless of what it's from. And so the fact that 9/11 is so important in our country, and to each of us individually, like we've pointed out a couple of times, I don't think there's anybody, even brain injury survivors, who, you know, one of the trademarks is our memory is shot, you know, short-term memory is like gone. But, you know, I don't think there's many of us that don't remember exactly where we were and what happened, and a couple of our guests have alluded to that today. And so the theme of being a survivor seemed appropriate tonight for our audience, even though my two guests were not brain injury survivors. You are survivors of a horrible trauma that no one should ever have to face. And I do appreciate you being here. Again, Anthea's book is called The First Responders: The Untold Story of the New York City Police Department and September 11th, 2001. Again, you can go to her website, www.antheaapple.com, or you can go to Amazon and type in her name in the search bar. That would be A-N-T-H-E-A space A-P-P-E-L. And that will take you to her book, which is only available, should only be available to be bought in the Kindle edition, because she's going to be releasing a new paperback book soon. So don't buy the one that is on
yeah,
on the
that's the old publishers. Yeah, the
that's
old publishers.
Right. And I know you had a hard time with them, but do you have any closing comments?
Not really.
Or anything else you'd like to say? Yeah, you've been good to be here for so long. I told you an hour,
yeah,
and you've been
I think
here
I've
a
talked
lot longer than that.
Closing statement.
Okay.
But,
well, then, what I would like to do then is to have you stay. One of the things I was going to do between you and Tim, and this is 4 minutes and 10 seconds. Hopefully you can hang for 4 minutes and 10 seconds, and then you can hang up, and I'm going to go ahead and put you on hold. But I want to thank you so much for being here tonight and sharing your story with our audience, and I really appreciate you being here, and I know that our audience does too. And like I said, you can contact Anthea through her website, or if you happen to miss that, you guys know you can find me at inaflash.org, and there's a contact the author tab that'll send me an email directly. If you're not, like I say, if you've missed all these posts and announcements I've made about her website, certainly a unique and different name. Where does your name originate?
My first name is Greek. I'm not Greek,
okay.
Though. My last name is, I don't know, German, Danish, I don't know. It's all kinds of, it's mixed up. French, je m'appelle Pelle, but, you know.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering about, the last name. But, yeah, if any of you out there didn't catch, I've been posting regularly in the chat room how to get a hold of her and announcing it on the show. But certainly, if you know, you guys know how to find me. If you have any questions for her, I'll see that they get passed on, or I'll get you her website and the link to her book. So, again, I'm going to thank you for being with us on this day, and I hope and know that you found writing that book painful but cathartic, and I'm glad that you were willing to share this day with me and my audience. And with that, I'll tell you goodnight, but if you can just hold on for 4 minutes, and then we'll be I'll be in touch.
Okay.
One of the things that I wanted to do between Anthea and Staff Sergeant Tim, some of you remember that are out there, that a couple of weeks ago we had a music show, and those of you that listen to my music regularly, I'm going to give you a tip-off. If you're out there and you're on Facebook, or no, excuse me, not Facebook, but if you have a tab open and you can go to YouTube, I'll give you a couple minutes and talk slow. If you can go to YouTube and type in the search window, Chris, C-H-R-I-S, space, Dukes, D as in dog, U-K-E-S, another space, and then Heroes, H-E-R-O-E-S, you'll get the video that goes to the song I'm going to play. Chris Dukes is a New Yorker, and he wrote this song, and there's an awesome video that goes with it, but I was hoping that Tim would be an intro at this moment, and that you would be an outro, but for both of you and all those affected by 9/11 and all of our audience, all of our survivors and caregivers out there, I want to dedicate a song that applies to all of you, and we'll take a 3-minute and 18-second break, and then I'll come back, and if Tim's not here, I will tell you some things about him that you'll find of interest. But this is a song called Heroes. Well deserved.
The young man holds a picture, his life within his hands, a wife and children far from Afghanistan. Time watch, he hopes silence keeps
and the walls you're tearing down. Your country is so proud, you're turning hearts around. And the love, we're saying prayers to safely get you home. With honor, that's the hero. A motto row, that's my brother, that's my sister, set it up against the cold. That's the hero, and always know. My brothers and my sisters standing up against the cold. My hero can always know.
Again, that was Chris Dukes with Heroes, and we certainly want to dedicate that to all of the brave survivors out there. And as those of you that watched the video that went with it know, it was a military-based video. And, you know, when you think about it, 9/11 is still happening every day. One of the things that I've learned as a host on here is I get to interview, I have the honor of interviewing a number of wounded warriors, and, you know, 9/11 was a lot more than just 9/11. It set off a domino effect. Some of the things like Anthea was talking about illnesses springing up years later, but you know, we also went to Iraq and Afghanistan, and we have a lot of fatalities there and a lot of survivors that I have, like I say, the honor of interviewing. There could be one of two reasons why Staff Sergeant Tim didn't make it. I still have my phone here, so if he calls in, we'll certainly let him on the line. We've got about 30 minutes left on the show, but I will read you some things. Thankfully, I pulled this off today, but Staff Sergeant Tim Chambers joined the Marines after high school in 1994. From Paris Island on, he credits his energy and enthusiasm with helping him land many interesting jobs, including protocol chief to a general stationed in Japan and assistant to the chief defense counsel for the Marines in Washington, a.k.a. Marines Defending Marines. Now, at this point, I was going to give Tim a little bit of grief. My dad is once a Marine, always a Marine, and he, too, was in Japan leading the Marine Corps tennis team. So I see he and Tim have something in common in tough duty over there in Japan, and I was going to tease him a little bit about that. On September 11th, 2001, however, his energy and enthusiasm took a more dramatic turn in Washington. When the Pentagon was hit, he raced to the scene with other Marines and helped in the rescue efforts, entering the building to look for survivors and bodies. 2 months later, Chambers and 10 other Marines were awarded the Navy and Marine Corps Commendation Medal. The whole ordeal reminded me of why the Marine Corps exists, said Chambers. We are trained to react. It was a gut check and helped me to decide to reenlist. For his heroics, he was invited to the 2002 Rose Bowl Parade to ride on a float with other 9/11 first responders. Rolling Thunder started Memorial Day weekend in 1988 when approximately 2,500 motorcycles from all over the country converged on Washington, D.C. to demand from our leaders a full accounting of all Vietnam POWs and MIAs. They vow to continue the ride until the last of the MIA POWs are brought home. It's estimated that the original 2,500 figures show participation has risen in the range of 900,000 between participants and spectators where Ride to the Wall has been incorporated. They originally rode to the Washington Monument, and now they go from the monument to the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Wall. Chambers first became aware of Rolling Thunder while he was stationed in Washington, and in 2002, the Marine decided to don his dress uniform and spend the day thanking veterans. But he didn't think that was enough. He'd attended many funerals on behalf of the Marines, but felt giving a salute at a vet's funeral was really too late. That was it, he said of his impulsive gesture. I just jumped out there as the parade was happening and popped up a salute. Then he started thinking, can I make it to the end? If I fall out, will I look like a complete idiot? While Chambers' annual salute, which lasts 3 to 4 hours, is a feat in itself, a serious medical condition has made the last 3 years especially challenging for him. After surgery in 2005, he contracted a serious bacterial infection, MRSA. In Chambers' case, the bacteria invaded his back muscles and causes flare-ups that require intense therapy and can leave him bedridden for months at a time. The recurring illness contributed to Chambers' decision to leave the Marines in 2009, which broke his heart. The Marine Corps has been my whole life since high school, he said, but I knew I could no longer serve, and I miss it a lot. Chambers joined the Marines right after high school in 1994, where he remained for 17 years until illness overcame him. For the last 3 years, Chambers has suffered flare-ups just prior to Rolling Thunder. In 2011, he was hospitalized for several months before the Memorial Day weekend. Added to that, Chambers also had a broken right wrist. And on that day is captured on YouTube, and if you go to YouTube and then you search out Marine Staff Sergeant Tim Chambers or SSGT Tim Chambers, you'll be able to see a YouTube video of him actually doing this in full uniform dress with all of the problems that he's had with the MRSA and a broken wrist, and he did it. He did it. He did 3.5 hours from the first motorcycle to the very last one, and he's been doing that every year since 2002. So for 11 years, he's been doing it. And since 2005, with a very bad bacterial infection that's been haunting him ever since. So I know that I got to speak with Marine Staff Sergeant Tim Chambers for quite a while when we booked the show a couple weeks ago, but I know that he had several engagements today, and I'm sure it's very hot down in Tucson, and I'm hoping that he's not having another flare of his illness, and that perhaps they just kept him a little longer and he wasn't able to get away from his other commitments, but he sure wanted to. That's for sure. He made the commitment to be here, and I have to think, being the kind of Marine he's demonstrated his that he's been, that something must have come up that he wasn't able to make it to us tonight. Where you can find him, though, we give him a little help, and maybe we can get him to come back on next year on September 11th and do his own show like Anthea did this year. You can find him, if you're on Facebook, then you know it's www.facebook.com/The Lone Marine. And his website is www.thesalutingmarine.com. So if you have any questions on that, again, you can feel free to write me at inaflash.org and hit the Contact the Author tab. That brings an email directly to me, and I will be happy to direct you. It looked like he had about 500 likes on that Facebook page, so we might help him plump that up a little bit, and sure hope that he's not sick tonight. When I talked to him, he was telling me about the MRSA and the illness in his back, and he spent a lot of time since 2005 in the hospital, so we're hoping that that's not something that's come up for him. I guess I should mention, we just have a few minutes left. If you want to call in and you have any questions, the number is 424-243-9540. Again, that's 424-243-9540. And if you have a question, when you call in, you press 1, and then I will know that your hand is up and that you have a question. I won't put anybody on the spot, but I know there's one Marine anyway out there listening tonight, and I said, gee, it's been a couple weeks since I booked this engagement with Staff Sergeant Tim. I said I've been trying to reach him. I know he was really busy traveling, doing some traveling to a number of different events over this week, and I said, you don't think he'll not make it, do you? And so I don't know if you're out there and you want to press 1, that other Marine, and say hi to the audience, feel free. I'm not sure that this person has ever attended one of my shows before. But I'm not seeing anyone press 1, so apparently they're not wanting to say hi to the United States and 36 countries and then be in an archive on-demand version. But in any case, I hope you guys enjoyed the show tonight. And let's see. Sorry, I'm going to look in my chat room real quick. Oh, I do have one more question, and we do have time. So we'll take this one question. Every now and then I do have to remind people to press 1. Otherwise, we assume that you're just parked and listening to the show through your telephone. And I want to tell a funny story. One time, you know, what happens here is that when you press 1, a question mark comes up on the switchboard, and that lets us know that you, quote-unquote, have your hand up. Well, there were some hosts guests in the beginning when we started this that didn't realize that. So whenever they saw a number on the switchboard, they would open the mic. And we heard some pretty interesting things when people didn't know that their mic wasn't going to be opened. In fact, one night we heard a pretty good argument going on, and the people didn't even realize that their mic was unmuted. And so now hopefully we hosts are all trained just to give a reminder that do press 1 if you have a question, and we'll know that you do. Wow, looks like a couple of them. Area code 940, who do we have?
Hello?
Area code 940, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, who's this?
Yes, this is Max from Ohio.
Okay, did you have a question or comment about the show tonight?
Well, actually, yes, I did have a comment. The party went well tonight. I just wanted to say that, you know, everyone had a good time tonight.
Well, thank you so much. I'm disappointed that that Tim didn't show up tonight, but I'm very honored that the rest of you showed up tonight for the show, and Anthea did a wonderful job. I hope you check out her book, First Responders, and looks like it's just got some amazing information in it. And thank you so much for calling in and letting
me
that,
you
know,
our
know
party
that,
was 420 friendly.
Wow. Where are you again?
Colorado.
Colorado. Okay. In mountain time, lucky you. It's hot and humid here down in the lower reaches of the Midwest right now. So I love Colorado, one of my favorite places to go.
Oh,
but
yeah.
Thank you. Thank you so much for calling in. It looks like I've got a couple more questions, and we only have about 20 minutes left in the show, so I hope you'll come back again. Brain Injury Radio is on 7 nights a week. I'm the regular Wednesday night host, and
well,
please come back
hi.
Again. I'd love
Shrek.
To talk to you.
Hi, Shrek. Hi, Shrek. Hi. Yes.
Bye-bye. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Shrek.
Okay, well, it looks like that Marine figured out how to press 1 on his phone, so I'm going to unmute the mic and say, area code 402, where'd my Marine go?
Here he is, right here. Are you
all
there?
Right. I'm there. I'm there. And so,
I'm trying to learn how to use my iPhone.
Yeah, there he goes. Les Paul and some of my regulars in the chat room, I'd like to introduce you to my father, Mark, and he's a Marine, once a Marine, always a Marine. So I want to welcome Semper Fi, that's right. So I want to welcome him to the show tonight, and at least I got a Marine on my switchboard for a couple of minutes tonight. So you were in Vegas when 9/11.
It's a good show, and it's very appropriate. Not only a game changer, but it's an attitude changer for the whole country. You can see that now we're having debates on whether or not we should go into Syria, and that follows
yes.
up with the situation with 9/11, where we were caught by surprise, and we threw some bombs over in Afghanistan, and all that stuff. Is aggravate them. So people are being more cautious about what they're thinking of doing now.
Right. Well, I'm hoping, you know, when I used to would have heard those stories in the past, I would have been all for it. But in the year that I've spent as a host on here talking to wounded warriors, and brain injury is the signature malady that these soldiers are coming home with, I really hope it doesn't come to that in Syria, and that we can pull back the reins. Like I said, 9/11 is the gift that keeps on giving as far as tragedy goes. So in any
the
case.
Two things seem to go together.
Yeah, that's
brain
right.
Injuries and, the brain injuries and 9/11 all go together.
Yeah.
A lot of healers out there that have done a lot of good things.
Yeah, there sure are. That's why I thought it was so appropriate, and I was very fortunate. This fella, Chris Dukes, was on my show last week who wrote the song Heroes, and I'm not sure if I sent you the link to that video, but if I didn't, I'll have to send it to you. It's a very moving video, and he's a very nice guy. And our gentleman host from Tuesday, Les Paul, said he will give you he needs training wheels for his iPhone also. So there's quite a few of us here that are in a general consensus that our smartphone is just a little smarter than we are. So in any case, thank you for calling in tonight.
Well, I love you. Is that all right to say?
Well, thank you. I love you too.
Good night.
Good night. That was cool. Don't think my parents have been to a show before. So that was great. I think we just had wait, was this Max
Hello.
Again?
So this is Paul.
Paul, I'm sorry. Area code 904. Paul, did you have a question or a comment about the show tonight? And welcome.
Yes, I've been hearing that 9/11 was a conspiracy that the government blew it up with the white man.
Yeah, we're not really talking about that tonight.
But it's kind of a concern for me. Ma'am?
Yes?
Right? It's a concern.
Yes. Definitely. Definitely. I know there's a lot of people that share that, and it may be true. You just never know, you know? You just never know. I'd like to think not.
Do you think it's true, ma'am?
I'd like to think not until I see concrete proof.
Well, do you think it was a curtain from the government for something else? Because not only what did we get from going into Iraq and Afghanistan? We got oil.
Right. Different show. I'm sorry. I do want to thank you for calling in, but we've got about 15 minutes left, and this is a topic
for another evening.
But thanks so much for calling. Area code 202, did you have something quick?
Hi, I do. Thank you so much, Kim. Great show, as usual. And I'm a new caller in to Brain Injury Radio. And I wanted to acknowledge...
Wait a minute. Is this Allie?
This is Allie, uh-huh.
Allie, yes. Thank you. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but welcome. I just met you the other night, and I appreciate you calling in. Now I'm sorry. Okay, everybody, this is Allie, and she's new here. And now I won't interrupt her. Allie.
Thank you. I'm doing well. I just wanted to support you and your efforts and your just wonderful contribution to the airwaves. And so I wanted to thank you for all that you do to raise awareness and to showcase individuals who might not otherwise have the opportunity to have a platform such as this. And I also wanted to acknowledge your guest and thank her for her courageous contribution. And I just, you know, wanted to mention that it's so important on a day such as today when we're memorializing all of those who've been impacted, whether directly or indirectly, and acknowledging and celebrating and paying homage to. It's just such a hotbed issue and very controversial, and I think it's important to recognize that no matter one's political affiliation, no matter one's belief with regard to the theories that have given rise to the events of 9/11,
person still gave their lives valiantly to really promote the well-being of not just this country, but the citizens of the country. And I just wanted to say that it's really important to acknowledge those individuals. I remember there have been times in years past that I've walked past, because I live in the Washington area. I live in Virginia, but the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area.
Sure.
And I see so many wounded warriors, so many persons who come back. And interestingly enough, even though technically speaking and from a politically correct standpoint, brain injury is the signature injury, the real injury, the real number one injury is amputations. But that doesn't look as good in terms of the public eye, and it really gives greater presence to what war is really about. War is hell, and anyone will tell you who's been in war, and certainly the older person. Normally, they say that war is for the youth, because a lot of times it's the young, brazen individuals who want to go, yeah, let's get them, let's, you know, do this and so. But anyone who served a tour of duty where they were in a war-torn area knows that it's not for anyone. I don't care how patriotic and all of that. And lives are forever changed. Lives are ruined. Hopes are dashed. And people come back in such a mangled state, not just physically but mentally as well. And so there's been times where I've walked past groups of people and not known what to say, because my mind is all aflutter with different thoughts and theories and, you know, all sorts of things. But I now have the position of just acknowledging and saying thank you for your service. Just something as simple as that, to acknowledge that this person put so much on the line in the name of freedom, in the name of freedom for not just them to save their own butts and their own families and loved ones' butts, but, you know, for everyone under the canopy of this great nation of ours. Even though it's not perfect, no nation is. It's still one of the greatest countries, if not the greatest country in the world. And so I just wanted to acknowledge all of those who have been impacted, like I said, whether directly or indirectly, not just from the events of 9/11, but the events that also are interconnected with 9/11.
Right, and I appreciate your comments, and they were talking in the chat, and a couple people have called about the conspiracy theories, and I said it's just, I'm not trying to be disrespectful, but it's about what you said. I just typed in the chat room, it's just not what my show is about tonight. It's a tribute, it's a memorial, it's a healing, and it's a united. As I said in the beginning of the show, in the first 5 minutes, I've had a bracelet on my wrist since a couple months after September 11th, 2001, that says, United We Stand. And tonight on my show, United We Stand, maybe another night, you know, for all of the rest. But, you know, tonight we're acknowledging loss together, and hopefully we're helping heal a little bit at a time together, or share the burden of the loss that I think a lot of us still feel on 9/11. So I appreciate those of you who understood that tonight, and I hope those of you that your call got lost will understand why this just wasn't on my agenda tonight. But thank you so very much for calling in. I really appreciate that very much. So
thank you.
Come back again, Allie. You're always welcome.
Thank you. I will. Thanks.
You bet. Looks like we've got Brent Taylor. Are you on the line?
Hello?
Yes, Brent. You're on the air.
I just wanted to say just thank you. for the radio show tonight. It was really touching, and you had a lot of really positive messages.
Thank you. I appreciate you calling in.
Thank you. Yeah, it just really brings me back. I just remember on that day when I saw the planes hit, I was in the kitchen and I heard it on the radio. I just remember, sorry, I'm a little bit emotional. I just remember just dropping the pod and just spaghetti everywhere. It was terrible. And just thank you for your radio show tonight.
Thank you for calling in, Brent. I think we all share a tear with you. Okay. Looks like that's it for the evening, folks. But again, I want to thank all of you who were here tonight. And again, I want to thank my sponsor, Lash Publishing. That's lapublishing.com, where you can find a lot of great information on brain injury and an extensive section of help materials for veterans. And what do you mean, Derek? Where did Kim go? Can you guys not hear me now? Anyway, lots of veteran-related materials and brain injury. So in any case, we're coming up at the top of the hour, and I'm going to close the show in my usual way, and that's with a positive note and a little more positive note, I guess. It's something that I believe that we all have, and I hope to see you all next week. Check out Frank tomorrow night and the rest of our hosts. We all have different personalities. We all bring something different to the table, but we're all there for you so that you're not alone in your recovery. And remember that within a half hour of the show going off, that these shows are all in archive. And so there's no reason that you ever have to be alone in your recovery. And I appreciate you listening tonight. And I'm going to close the show, like I said, in the usual way with something I believe we all have. And that is a guardian angel. This is Guardian Angel by Leah West, LEAHWEST.com. Hope you check her out. She's a great gal. And thank you for being here at the show tonight. I think we just crossed over. It's 10:12 now, and I appreciate you sharing the evening with me.
Higher than your thought was.